Welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast. I'm your host, Sam Charrington.
All right, everyone. I am super excited to be on the line with Yashua Bengio. Yashua is a professor in the Department of Computer Science and Operations Research at the University of Montreal and the founder and scientific director of Mila. Yashua, welcome to the TWIML AI Podcast.
Hi, it's good to be here.
It is super exciting for me to have you on the line. I've already said super exciting twice, so maybe that's an indication of my enthusiasm for the opportunity to chat with you a little bit about your work. Your name is certainly well known among our audience and your contributions to this field. I read somewhere that you are ranked as the most cited computer scientist worldwide, or one of?
In terms of recent contributions, yes. So
okay.
There are people who have been in the field longer than me, and I'm among the young, old people.
Nice. And just last year, you, along with Jeff Hinton and Jan LeCun, received the ACM Turing Award for your contributions with deep learning, deep neural networks. Why don't we start with having you tell us a little bit about that journey and
Sure.
you know, how you came to work in AI and on deep learning. And, you know, of course, we'll get to what you're working on now, but let's start with, you know, some of that background.
Yeah, deep learning, neural nets, it's been my life, my professional life, at least. I had started, I would say, as an adolescent, reading a lot of science fiction and getting acquainted with the notion of AI and robots and so on, with the three laws of robotics and all that, and movies like 2001 Space Odyssey. And then at university, I studied first computer and electrical engineering and then computer science in my master's, and I had to choose a topic, and by chance, I got to read some of the early neural net papers from people like Jeff Hinton, and I realized that this was the field I wanted to work on because it was about trying to understand the principles that would explain our own intelligence as humans, and intelligence is very central to who we are, and then building machines thanks to understanding these principles, like the way that we understand how birds fly, but we're not necessarily copying the birds. We are trying to understand those principles so we can build airplanes that also fly.
A lot of your recent work is focused on this idea of consciousness. You know, what's the relationship between consciousness and intelligence?
Very good question. Well, so first of all, let me put things in perspective about deep learning. So a lot of the progress we've made in deep learning and neural nets in the last few decades has helped us to build machines that can do pretty well at some of the things that brains are good at, including perception, the ability to understand images, sounds, and so on. But there are also things that humans do with their brain, the things that we are conscious of. So when you decide to do something and you're able to report what you're thinking about or why you do something, that kind of cognitive ability, which is associated with being conscious of it, is not something that we're good at in AI right now. And some people might even think that it's incompatible with all of the ideas that have been put forward with the neural nets and deep learning. And it's more related to some of the older ideas in AI based on symbols and logic and expert systems. But actually, your brain is a huge neural net that we need to understand better. And the good news is that in the last two or three decades, neuroscientists, cognitive neuroscientists have made a lot of progress in understanding what is going on in your brain when you're doing something consciously, which parts of your brain get activated in what order and so on. And so whereas the research on consciousness was almost something taboo in the 20th century, in this century, it is something that has become, you know, an important topic of serious science. And so my research now is at the cusp of this transformation where computer science and AI research are starting to take stock of what has been discovered in neuroscience and try to take some of these ideas and import them into new types of deep learning systems that would come with the advantages of being conscious, which I can also explain.
One of the ways that you describe the relationship between the type of deep learning systems that we have today and this model that you see as a possibility as we start to incorporate these ideas of consciousness is System 1 and System 2, coming from Daniel Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit on, you know, these two different systems, as he puts it. And for my curiosity, was that an inspiration for the way you're thinking about this now, or did it become a handy explanation for some of what you're doing?
Oh, it's definitely an inspiration. His work and the work of psychologists and neuroscientists who have helped clarify the different types of functions that are being that are happening in your brain has really helped me and others think about how modern AI systems could incorporate these things. So first of all, realizing that you have these two very different types of cognitive abilities. So System 1 is the kinds of things that deep learning is good at right now, the kinds of things you can do in half a second, right? So you see an image, you know that it's a cat, and you don't need to think about it. It happens automatically. In fact, you don't even need to be conscious of it. It's something that we can see in your brain that if it's maybe happening on the side or you have not enough time, your brain will record that it's a cat, but it doesn't even get to your consciousness. So these things are intuitive and they're hard to verbalize. Like, you can't explain why you recognize that this was a cat. I mean, you could try to explain it, but it's not a good explanation. In fact, a lot of the earlier failures of computer vision research was that we were trying to take our own internal explanation. So, you know, what is it that makes a cat, and take that and transfer that into algorithms.
Right.
But it was never, you know, very good, because there's a lot of the way that our brain does it, which we don't have access to. Mm-hmm. So everything that is intuitive, that is at a, you know, subverbals, unconscious level, is roughly System 1. There are some differences between, you know, conscious, unconscious, and System 1, System 2, but it's a good way to first order to understand things. And System 2 is instead the things you typically do consciously, the things that you can report, the things that you can verbalize. Not everything can be verbalized, but a lot of the things that are you're conscious of can be verbalized, and that you do in sequence. It's like at each step, you might be involving intuitive computation in your brain, but you're going to sequence these things in your mind in a way that you control and that gives you an extra power, an extra flexibility, which allows us to do things like learn to drive or learn to drive in a new city or figure out what to do in some unusual circumstances where we have to be creative and find solutions on the spot. And it doesn't look like anything we've seen before. This kind of very powerful, dynamically adaptive behavior that humans employ to solve new problems is very typical of System 2. And current AI isn't very good at these things. Current AI, if you train the systems on some data and then you deploy them in situations that are not exactly the same kind, you get a big hit in performance. It doesn't work as well. Whereas humans are able to transfer their knowledge to new domains, to new environments much more easily. And very often, this is when you use your conscious strengths. So when you're doing something habitual, you don't need to think about it. So the example I give is when you're driving on the usual path, you can talk to the person besides you. You're conscious of the conversation, but you don't need to be conscious of the details of the road. I mean, mm-hmm. Of course, you're taking chances when you're doing that. But the point is, a lot is going on unconsciously because it's something familiar that you have seen a lot and you don't need to be mindful of it. Whereas when you're doing something that's more unusual and you need to practice a new skill or to have a new coherent way of putting together pieces of knowledge, you're using System 2 and you're using conscious processing.
It was interesting to me that in your description of these two systems, you talked about unvocalized or subverbal and things that we can vocalize and put into words. And in your descriptions of consciousness. You use the examples of language a lot to represent these ideas. And I'm curious the relationship between language as a construct and consciousness.
Yeah, this is obviously an open question. So you have to realize that the science of consciousness is something fairly new, as I said, like a couple of decades, a bit more. And there are a lot that we need to understand. So we have to be very humble about how much we don't know. But yeah, it seems very obvious that there's a very strong connection between language and consciousness, but they're not equivalent. For example, you might have things that are happening in the area of your brain that deals with language that are kind of different from the things that have to do with being conscious of something. So, but there are strong connections. And in fact, one of my current research tracks is to exploit a hypothesis that that connection is very tight, in the sense that the high-level concepts that you manipulate consciously also correspond to things like words, like things that you can verbalize. Mm-hmm. And so at the representation level, the two things are very close to each other.
Yeah, there's been past work, nothing that I could cite or that I know intimately, but you know, that we kind of talk about generally that, you know, for example, in some cultures, they don't have words for, you know, certain types of things. And the implication being that that kind of conditions their thought in certain directions that, you know, differs from other cultures. And it seems very much in line with this idea of consciousness as you're defining it.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, the way that I want to use this hypothetical connection is to help the learning of these high-level concepts. So what deep learning is about, which I didn't have time to say earlier, is learning good representations. Mm-hmm. And we've been very good at learning, let's say, low-level and mid-level representations with deep learning, especially on the visual input. But we don't yet have good algorithms to discover the right variables at high-level concepts that humans manipulate consciously. Of course, we can kind of cheat by telling machines this is a cat, this is a dog, and then they kind of know what is a cat and a dog by example. But what we don't have is an ability to discover these high-level things. And so by connecting, say, video input with a corresponding language in the right way, we can force a deep learning system to learn representations which at the top level would have features, if you want, that correspond to words or phrases or linguistic constructs. And that would help the representation learning system discover those high-level concepts in the same way that when we talk to children, using words in particular context helps them build the corresponding meaning of those words in their mind.
But of course, they don't need the words. They're building meaning absent of the words.
And initially, they learn a lot of things that they don't have words for. But it's actually difficult to disentangle these things, because even though it might take a couple of years before they start talking, during those couple of years, they also hear a lot of language. Mm. Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting clue is that in some cultures, parents don't talk to their children. They talk with each other, and the children just listen. Whereas in our Western cultures, we tend to talk a lot to our babies. Mm-hmm. So you might think that they're learning from that interaction. But it looks like even without a direct sort of naming, this is a cat, this is a dog, the babies can catch the connection between the labels, the words, and the things in the world.
So we jumped in pretty quickly and started talking about some of the implications of how you're defining consciousness. But you really launched into this field with a paper in 2017, The
That's
Consciousness
right.
Prior.
That's right.
What exactly is The Consciousness Prior? And maybe tell us the main points that you're trying to convey in that paper.
Okay, I'm going to try to do that in an accessible way.
Yeah.
So first of all, what does the word prior mean? It's a term we use in machine learning research to say that the learning system is exploiting some kind of assumption about the world. And there's even theorems that say that you have to have assumptions, at least minimal ones, in order to be able to learn successfully. And so the brain has these kinds of assumptions about the world that, you know, we inherit from our ancestors through that have, you know, and these assumptions have encoded somehow in our genes. And we are born with those things. And they help us to learn faster and better in the world around us. And so when I said at the beginning that one of my research goals is to understand the principles that give rise to intelligence, well, an important part of this is what are the kinds of assumptions that humans exploit about the world that allow us to learn efficiently about it, to build, to understand how it works, to learn language, to learn to model the world, to act in the world, and so on. So notions, you can think of things like, well, notions of time and space, of agency, that, you know, I do things and there are effects, and so on, are probably things that we got from our genes and that our brain is exploiting as some kind of assumptions about the world. And so the consciousness prior is one such assumption which would be connected with the notion of consciousness, but I actually have a whole list of related assumptions, but this one is very central. So what it says is there are two kinds of knowledge about the world, which is somewhere in our brain. And that's basically the system one knowledge and the system two knowledge, right? So the system one knowledge is knowledge that is difficult to put in words, as we were defining system one this way, essentially. Whereas system two knowledge is knowledge that is easy to put in words. Now, what kind of knowledge has the property that it can easily put in words? Well, there is a nice structural property of the kind of knowledge we can communicate with words. And the property is that we are able to make predictions about things that can happen, about words, given other things that we know. So, for example, if I say, if I drop my phone, it will fall on the ground, that sentence only involves a few concepts. It involves a phone, it involves the ground, it involves the act of dropping and the result, right? That's very few elements, if you think about it. Normally, when you try to make a prediction about something in the world, you need a whole lot of other things to make that prediction accurate. So if I'm trying to predict the next pixel that will show up at some position in the video that I'm seeing right now, I need to know about all the other pixels and all the pixels that I've seen in the last few seconds or something, or minutes. And that's like millions of numbers that come into that prediction. So pixels are difficult to manipulate, to explain with language. They don't have this property. But instead, if I explain the world in terms of objects that I can name, like I did with my phone that could drop on the ground, this way of representing information, of representing knowledge, is one where we can make statements about things that should be true and things that should not be true. Where each of those statements only involves very few concepts. So with natural language, we can communicate a lot of knowledge about the world, but it's decomposed into little pieces like sentences. In each of these sentences only involves very few concepts. So in machine learning jargon, we say we can summarize this in a single phrase. We could say that the joint distribution of the high-level concepts is sparse. Sparse here means that, you know, if you draw the connections between all the concepts as a graph, the graph has very few edges coming out of each node. So each node corresponds to a concept, and each concept is attached to other concepts through very few edges, right? So that
you're saying the graph between the connections between the concepts in that sentence, or the concepts in all the things that
all
we
the
know?
Things that you could say. If you think about all the things that you could say,
right?
You decompose all the things that you could say into sentences. Okay, just to make it keep it simple. Now each sentence is like a special kind of node in the graph, and each sentence connects to very few words. Now, the words are connected to all of the sentences that they could appear in, but each of these sentences only involves very few words. And so overall, the structure of that graph is extremely sparse. Whereas if I were to draw a graph of the statistical dependencies between pixels, it would almost need to be like fully connected, that every pixel needs to talk to every pixel. So what happens is that your brain has created these high-level variables, high-level concepts, which allow to decouple a lot of the complicated dependencies that would otherwise seem to exist. And in addition, so that's the consciousness problem, but there are like side statements to this. So one of them is that those high-level variables have to do with causality, right? So those dependencies, when I said if I drop the phone, it's going to fall on the ground, it's also like a causal statement, right? It says something about if I do a particular action, this is going to be the consequence. And there's an object which is going to be affected by the action of dropping the phone. Mm-hmm. And so this is important because causality allows us to understand the world in a strong sense that is goes beyond making predictions. It allows us to imagine what could happen, for example, or what could have happened. These are called counterfactuals.
You give an example in your in some of your talks on this about putting on sunglasses and yes. that simple act which can be reduced to
one bit.
Changes has a significant implications on yes. All the pixels that are firing in your retina, but it's a single bit.
Yeah. So exactly, and so I was talking about causality earlier, and one of the particularly interesting aspects of causality is that it tells us about how the world typically changes. So it's not just about how the concepts are related to each other, but how these relations change over time due to agents like people or robots eventually and animals doing things. Mm-hmm. And what happens is that those changes are very localized in the sense that they involve only one or a few concepts. So typically when you come up with an explanation for something that has happened, and our brain constantly tries to come up with explaining what is going on verbally, we end up being able to provide a very short explanation, like one sentence. Oh, he dropped the phone. But this is amazing, right? Because the world has changed. Like I've put on these dark glasses and I'm able to explain it by referring to very few things. I have put on my dark glasses. Whereas if you didn't have that assumption, you might imagine that everything has changed and you can't do any prediction anymore. But now the fact that it's very few things that have changed allow you to recover from those changes. And this is what humans are good at. They're good at recovering from changes that are happening in the world. So that's this adaptive strength skill that humans have that we would like to put in machines. So this whole research on consciousness is not just about understanding an important part of who we are, which is clearly, consciousness is a big part of it, but it's also building those abilities in machines to be more robust to the changes that can happen in the environment.
The idea of consciousness, then you kind of express it as this low dimensional representation of the broader connections that are in the brain or that are in, some system that we don't have yet. That's related to the idea of attention that we've yes. been experimenting with in neural networks. What's the connection between those?
Yes. Very good question. And actually, it's a tough one because a lot of people still don't see the connection. So let me try to explain it. So remember I said that we're exploiting this assumption that the dependencies between concepts have this sparsity. Like, pieces of knowledge, each would be like a sentence. Now, if you want a machine or a brain to compute over that knowledge base that we have in our brain or in a computer, you want to take advantage of that sparsity. And a good way to do it is to focus the computation on just the right pieces at each step, because then you only need to consider the interactions between a few variables. That's much easier, both in terms of computations and in terms of what we call the statistical advantage. So if something changes, then we can learn it quickly if it involves only a few variables. So attention is a way to exploit this inherent sparsity, the assumed sparsity that I'm talking about, so that we can do this very special kind of computation that involves very few variables at a time. So attention selects just these few variables that come into our working memory. And then we can utter a sentence to share what we have in our mind, but there's more to this. The fact that we have this attention bottleneck, which is also this bottleneck is a central piece of current theories of consciousness, forces the part of the knowledge about the world which should go in system two to go there. So only the things that can go through this bottleneck that involves little pieces of knowledge involving a few variables at a time are being represented at that level. The stuff that you can't handle with consciously goes, you know, system one, and it takes more time to learn because it's about the interaction of many things together, like extracting information from images. But the stuff that somehow has this property, the consciousness prior property of the that will be processed by system two, and now you have, you know, advantages because you can do things at that level. Because you exploit that sparsity, you can quickly, you know, reason and do all kinds of things, plan, that are harder to do otherwise.
Is the idea there that this system two, you know, if we think of it as like a memory, you know, it the bottleneck says that it can't just store anything, it can only store these higher level concepts or representations. Is that?
You're right. We only store the stuff that goes through our consciousness. So the things that you're unconscious of are going to stay in your mind, in your brain, you know, very short time, and then you're going to forget them. Whereas the things that you've been conscious of are more likely to be stored in long-term memory. But in addition, when they go through this short-term memory, that where you can operate on them, you can do pretty fancy things. That is what we call thinking or reasoning or planning, mm-hmm. or discovering something incoherent and that we do consciously.
So is the idea of attention as applied to consciousness that we might use attention as a way to train this consciousness prior?
Yes. So attention is part of the architecture of the neural net in order to enforce the prior. What's interesting is it has already brought a kind of revolution within deep learning. So there's been amazing mm-hmm. progress in natural language processing. It started with the work we did in machine translation around mm-hmm. 2014. And then since 2016, this has been put in Google Translate. And then, you know, it's become the dominant kind of technology for machine translation. But since then, with new architectures that exploit consciousness, like what's called the transformers, the progress in all kinds of natural language tasks has really, really progressed a lot. Mm-hmm. And it's changing the very nature of the way we think about neural nets. So in the traditional neural net, we think of the computation as operating one step at a time on these vectors, so like a fixed set of numbers, which correspond to, you know, a bunch of neurons having some activity. But when you have attention mechanisms, what it makes it possible is to operate on sets of objects rather than on these fixed size vectors. So already this is having a big impact in natural language processing, because language has this property that, you know, you want to just take some elements of what I've been talking about in the last 5 minutes and then reuse it in order to say something you know that makes sense with respect to what I said. So it tends to select a few elements, combine them in new ways, add some new things, but at each step you only consider a few things at a time. And current transformer architectures have this inherent structure. Another thing that's going on with these attention-based systems is that, in a way, we are introducing some of the old ideas from AI of indirection and naming things and having things that have a type. So these are concepts that have been there since the beginning of programming, but haven't really, it wasn't clear how to incorporate these ideas in neural nets. And so with attention, there's something really interesting going on, which is now you select which neuron, for example, is going to talk to which neuron. So it's kind of like dynamically changing the connection pattern between neurons or groups of neurons. And so when you have this dynamic connectivity going on, you need to carry information about where is the signal coming from. So it's not just the information I send you, but, you know, it's coming from me, and you need to keep track of that.
In a lot of ways, the idea of a consciousness prior makes me think of the work that's happening around model-based machine learning. Yes. So in reinforcement learning, for example. You know, we're starting to see a lot of work, or we've been seeing quite a bit of work around models. Is the idea that the consciousness prior is like the specific type of model that's analogous to, you know, what you would call our consciousness?
So the connection with model-based reinforcement learning is the following. When you do model-free reinforcement learning, you train a policy. In other words, you train a neural net, which is going to be called whenever you have to take a decision, and it takes a decision and it's sort of automatic. So it's like when you're driving on a habitual route and you don't need to think about it, it knows what to do. And there's no need to involve consciousness. But when you plan a new route on the fly, let's say there's some funny construction going on your road, and you know, suddenly you realize that you're going to have to use a different path, and you think about it, that is planning on the fly. And that kind of planning on the fly is a form of reasoning and is something that's conscious. And that allows you to deal with these unexpected occurrences. And that, in principle, is exactly what model-based reinforcement learning is about. So once you have a model of how the world works, you can create a new policy on the fly, right? Something you've never done before, by combining the pieces of knowledge you already know, say about pieces of roads and so on, in order to come up with a new plan. And that sort of dynamic decision-making about the future and imagining the future in order to take decision in a very flexible way is very, very characteristic of conscious behavior and system two. So I think that at the end of the day, we're going to have reinforcement learning that has both model-free elements and model-based elements, because they both have their strengths.
So earlier I referred to this idea of consciousness prior as like a memory. Is it strictly speaking memory in nature, or is it more active? Does that question make sense?
Yes, it's more active. So it's more about how you process information, but the connection to memory is, it's also connected to how we represent a lot of conscious knowledge. So the things that you can access in memory are conscious pieces of information. I mean, they're not conscious until you retrieve them from memory, but they can become conscious. And so there's a sense in which a lot of your conscious knowledge is stored in your long-term memory, and then it could be retrieved as needed in order to solve problems that you're facing today. And conscious processing is dealing with the computations that your brain is doing to do these things, to retrieve things from memory, to interpret what you're seeing now, and potentially also to visualize things that could happen in the future.
I think the memory analogy was that it was kind of the store of the relationships between things.
Yeah. So,
but the planning based on that information is a total, that's not necessarily, you know, the same thing.
That's right. Yeah. So there's in a sense, there is declarative knowledge. So all the pieces of knowledge that are in memory, and then there's the computation that you do on the fly in order to combine these pieces of knowledge with what is going on now or what you're imagining in order to come up with sometimes better explanations about the past or about what you'd like to do in the future.
What's kind of the current state of this line of research, and how do you see it evolving?
Oh, it's still in its infancy. Think how many decades it took for like neural nets and deep learning as it stands now to really reach the maturity that it has. So I think this is a long-term project. And I also think that there's a huge importance in the collaboration between the brain sciences. And that include cognitive science, neuroscience, but also philosophers of mind, which have been thinking about consciousness and mind for a long time. So all of these people who have been thinking about the human side of the equation should be collaborating with the people in AI and deep learning who are interested in understanding those principles and trying different ways of capturing these things in computers. And that can go also back in the other direction, because one of the problems with, say, neuroscience or philosophy is that it's it's difficult to come up with good theories that explain the many observations that we have. But machine learning can come up with interesting theories because they are motivated from the learning theory point of view. In other words, so like my consciousness prior idea is something that makes sense from a machine learning perspective, because it's as soon as you start making assumptions about the world, that means you could learn faster, you could adapt faster. And so these kinds of justification can help constrain theories that neuroscience or philosophers might be considering. So they would, at the end of the day, be theories that both are consistent with what we know about humans and that make sense from a computational perspective, from a learning perspective.
Before we got started talking about consciousness, we were actually before we started recording, we were talking a little bit about kind of what's going on in the world now as we record this mid-March and COVID-19. And one of the other topics that you've been spending some time working on is how machine learning and AI could make a difference in that setting. Can you share with us a little bit of what you're doing there?
Yes, just to put a bit of context. So I've been involved, of course, in basic research in machine learning and deep learning for many decades. But also in the last few years, I've realized the importance of thinking about how AI is deployed, will be deployed in society, and how we can steer our collective boat in directions that will make AI a useful force for the world and for humanity. So this is why I got embarked, for example, in the project of writing the Montreal Declaration for Responsible Development of AI. This is why I'm involved in a project called AI Commons to try to help developers and NGOs and philanthropy work together on applying AI to areas that, you know, have really AI for social good that may not be necessarily profitable, but are important to do for humanity. This is also why I've been involved in the last couple of years in working on how AI could be used to fight climate change. So we wrote a very long paper that does a survey of many different areas in which machine learning can be used to help reducing greenhouse emissions, to design new materials, to better use the renewable energy sources that we have, or to even help people understand better what is going on with climate change. And then, of course, in the last few weeks, like everyone else, I've been into this tornado to try to think with many of my colleagues, not just in AI, but also in other, especially in healthcare, thinking about what AI can do among many other disciplines that are, you know, putting their brains together. What can we do to help fight this COVID-19 pandemics? So I'm currently involved in a number of projects. One that is taking a lot of my time these days is the design of a tracing app. So one of the things that we can do to really find a good balance between saving lives and allowing people to go out of their homes is keeping track of where people go and who they meet, so as to estimate their risks of being infected and reduce those risks. And we want to do it in a way that's very mindful of privacy, maybe unlike some of the apps that have already been put out there.
Yeah, this has come up quite a bit recently.
Yes, it's very important.
Use Bluetooth and make the information available to, you know, the benevolent government agencies.
That's right. So I don't think it would pass in North America. And I think there are good reasons for this. But the good news is there are technical solutions to this, and we're working on that. And we're working on machine learning to help predict your risk level based on the encounters you had before. So, you know, maybe you didn't meet somebody. You didn't meet somebody who we knew was infected, but maybe you met somebody who met somebody who met somebody who was infected. So then, what's the probability that you are infected, right? And you've made 20 of these encounters, so maybe the risks accumulates, right? So how do you aggregate all that information and help people know what is their risk? Another thing we're working on is the design of new drugs. So machine learning and especially deep learning has been used in the last couple of years. There's been a flurry of papers using these systems to propose new candidate drugs. And in particular, we're working on antivirals. In other words, drugs that you would give to somebody who's already sick and maybe who's very sick and we are, you know, concerned that they might die. And so we could give them these experimental drugs because these are new things. And so there's a problem where machine learning can come handy is that the normal, usual development of new drugs could take many years, sometimes a decade. But it turns out that machine learning can greatly accelerate the search for good molecules.
When you're talking to clinicians and practitioners, folks from the healthcare side of things, as well as virologists and epidemiologists and kind of the end users of systems like these, what are the things that they say they need from, you know, us as a community of data scientists, machine learning researchers, and the like?
Well, it's not always easy to get that answer. I can tell you, I've been learning a lot in the last few weeks. And I'm sure a lot of people have been learning a lot because we all need to understand what is going on. Mm-hmm. So there are many questions. On the healthcare and clinical side, they would like to be able to predict, just monitor what is going on is already difficult. And predict where there might be greater need for healthcare resources, to allocate resources properly. Predict what patient, given their history, would be most likely to need like an ICU or a respirator. Predict the risk level of people, as I was mentioning earlier. Help epidemiologists model what, you know, what's going to be the likely scenarios that we're going to be facing. Even things like logistics. So there are a lot of problems right now where we're just not organized properly to deal with the massive number of people calling for help, right? Mm-hmm. So there's just lots and lots of areas where machine learning can be useful. And it takes a lot of time to understand those issues, to talk to those people. To get access to data is a big thing. But now the good news is, in our societies, access to healthcare data has been a huge problem because we've put all of our weight on privacy, and it has meant that it's been difficult for researchers, machine learning researchers, to have access to this kind of data. But now what is happening with COVID is that the health authorities are seeing that we're missing a boat, like, or they're, you know, quickly changing the ways that we're doing things to allow researchers to get their hands on the proper data sets, or we're gonna lose lives where, you know, we could have saved those lives. Mm-hmm. So I think it's an important moment to demonstrate the need for a more agile data infrastructure for healthcare.
With regards to the app that you mentioned, we've talked quite a bit on the podcast about differential privacy. Does that come into play in allowing you to use this location data in a private way?
We're looking at different options. Right now, I don't think we need differential privacy. So we may need to blur some pieces of evidence that would make it too easy to retrace people. Mm-hmm. But if you want to predict the risk level of a person, in other words, predict the probability that you are currently infected, you don't need to know where I was. You only need to know that, maybe yesterday I was close to somebody who had risk level 6, and the day before I was close to somebody who had risk level 7, mm-hmm. and so on. And you don't need to know the kind of trace of where everyone was. That can be computed in each person's phone. The only thing you need to share as data for training the risk predictor is what were the encounters, like in the sense of what were the risk level of people you encountered and when. And that, from that information, is very difficult to trace who met with whom, because you don't have a handle on who was where when. So I think that we could globally share the level of the planet, that kind of data, and build very good models of your risk level.
You know, when you look across all of the things that are happening, you know, your research and elsewhere, what are the things that you see as most exciting in terms of AI's contribution to this fight?
Wow, I guess I'm very biased. So I'm most invested right now in this tracing thing because I think that medical treatments are going to take months, probably, you know, year-ish, 2 years, for, in some cases, to converge to something everyone can have, especially vaccines. You have to understand that before we release a vaccine, we need to make sure this drug is really, really harmless because we're going to give it to everybody, right? So
right, right. And that process 1%, takes a while.
Yeah, exactly.
Even if it's fast tracked, it still takes a while.
If 1% of the people we give a vaccine to die because of the vaccine, that is not good, okay?
Right.
But a antiviral is a drug you could give to somebody who's already close to dying anyways, and so we can take a bigger chance. And so we don't need to wait a year or two to know that it's okay. And so I'm invested in the project around the development of new antivirals. Before that, there are already been work in using machine learning to test existing drugs. This is like the first line. Is there a drug that has already been approved, so we don't need clinical trials, that we can just use tomorrow morning? Okay, that's already going on. There's a bunch of clinical trials going on with promising leads, and machine learning has already been used to suggest candidates. But the next step, if none of these things work, is to develop a new molecule that didn't exist. All right. So the tracing thing is very important because it's something we can do even before all this, right? Even before we find those drugs and do clinical trials for them, we should be able, in a matter of days and weeks, to all have on our phone an app that will help trace our contacts in a privacy respecting way and make it possible for us to meet, for example, other people and know that they're unlikely to be infected. And so it's okay. We can be close to each other. We can work together. We can be in the same bus together. This is very important. A lot of people right now don't have any transportation because if you don't have a car or if you don't drive and you're infected, for example, you can't have transportation. So like we need to know who is likely to be infected and not, or at what degree, in order to organize society around this for the next probably 1 or 2 years.
Well, super important work. Thank you so much for taking the time to chat with us about what you're up to, both the work that you've been focusing on broadly, the consciousness work, as well as the more recent work you've been doing in this fight against COVID.
My pleasure.
It's been great to speak with you. Thank you.
Bye.
All right, everyone. That's our show for today. For more information on today's show, visit twimmelai.com/shows. As always, thanks so much for listening and catch you next time.